Chapter 10, Preparing to Receive the Sacred Relics. Know thyself was the injunction of one of the sages of ancient Greece, an injunction that was also inscribed on a pillar in the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. But neither in the ancient nor in the modern world has it ever been easy for a man truly to know himself. At the time that I was staying at Burma Raja's guest cottage and becoming better acquainted with such traditions and individual talents as were represented in the little town of Kalimpong, I was still far from knowing myself. In particular, I was far from knowing the extent of my own capabilities. This was in part due to circumstances. Having spent much of my childhood as an invalid, and my 3 years in the army doing work for which I was quite unsuited and which I cordially detested, I had come to think of myself as an essentially impractical kind of person whose real interests and real life lay in a completely different world. Like Baudelaire's albatross, I felt more at home in the sky than on the ship's deck, even though my wings were as yet far from being fully developed. This impression of myself as lacking in practicality had been reinforced during my 2 years as a wandering ascetic. Satchapriya, the companion of my wanderings, was an exceptionally active and capable person, with more than a touch of the desire to lead and to dominate. He it was who took all the decisions and made all the practical arrangements, leaving to me the role of admiring spectator of his energy and ability. The contemplation of my impracticality in comparison with his own extreme competence indeed gave him a pleasant sense of superiority. In Kalimpong I was threatened with the repetition of the same kind of pattern. Though deferring to me in all matters of a purely religious nature, both Joe and Swale were inclined to regard me as hopelessly impractical where mundane affairs were concerned, and as quite incapable of running the YMBA without the advice and guidance of my older and more experienced friends. They only differed as to which of these older and more experienced friends I should allow myself to be advised and guided by. Since they could not agree on this all-important point, and between them often gave me contradictory advice, I usually did whatever I myself thought best. Indeed, I had no alternative. Nevertheless, despite the modest success that the YMBA in general, and Stepping Stones in particular, had already achieved, I still tended to think of myself as an impractical rather than a practical person. It was only in connection with the arrival of the sacred relics in Kalimpong in March 1951 that Joe and Swale were proved wrong about me, and I was able to come to a better knowledge of my own capabilities, and to that extent to a truer knowledge of myself. The sacred relics in question were those of the arahants Shariputra and Moggallana, the two chief disciples of the Buddha. They had been discovered in the middle of the last century when General Sir Alexander Cunningham opened the stupas, or memorial mounds, at Sanchi in central India. In one of these stupas he found two small steatite boxes containing fragments of bone and inscribed respectively Shariputras and Moggallanas in Brahmini characters of the time of Ashoka. These important finds were taken to England and deposited in the Victoria and Albert Museum, where they remained until 1947. In that year, the British government handed them over to the Mahabodhi Society for enshrinement in the land of their origin. And after spending 2 years in Ceylon, the sacred relics, as they were now universally called, were the occasion of public rejoicings on an unprecedented scale. Their arrival in India was, in fact, treated as a state function, with the Prime Minister, Pandit Nehru, coming specially to Calcutta to receive them and hand them over to the President of the Mahabodhi Society for safekeeping until such time as they could be properly enshrined. The brilliant and historic ceremony took place in the presence of some 500,000 people, among whom were representatives of the Buddhist countries of Asia, in colourful national costume, and the ensuing festivities lasted a whole month. Originally, the Mahabodhi Society had intended to enshrine the sacred relics in New Delhi, but later it had second thoughts, and in this case, second thoughts proved to be better than first thoughts. The sacred relics would be enshrined in Sanchi, which had already been their home for more than 2,000 years, and they would be enshrined, not in the stupa where General Cunningham had found them, but in a brand new temple. Work on the Chetyagiri Vihara, as the new temple was to be called, had in fact started in 1946, but the building would not be ready until 1952. In the meantime, the relics of the two arahants were to remain in Calcutta. They were far from remaining there uninterruptedly, however. Invitations came pouring in from all over India, as well as from different parts of the Buddhist world, and the sacred relics had already been taken to Bihar, the United Provinces, Assam, Burma, and Ladakh. Everywhere they went, they were received with tremendous popular enthusiasm. I had paid my own respects to them in Benares, the citadel of Hindu orthodoxy, and when Kashyapji and I visited the holy places of Bihar, we found that their presence there a few months earlier had resulted in a great upsurge of devotion and given rise to a demand for the revival of Buddhism. Now, having returned from their triumphal tour of Ladakh, the sacred relics were to be given a state reception by the government and people of Sikkim, the dark blue foothills of which could be seen away to the north on the other side of the river Teesta. As soon as I heard the news, I realised that here was a wonderful opportunity. If the sacred relics were visiting Gangtok, there was no reason why they should not visit Kalimpong too. All we had to do was invite them. A visit from the sacred relics would undoubtedly give Buddhism in Kalimpong a tremendous boost, and in this way make the work of the YMBA much easier. I therefore wrote at once to David Priya Valasinha, the General Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society, inquiring if the sacred relics could be brought to Kalimpong for exposition immediately after their visit to Gangtok. Valasinha replied that they could, provided that a strong representative committee was set up, and provided this committee undertook to bear the entire cost of the visit. The sacred relics would be in Sikkim at the end of February, and I could expect them in Kalimpong at the beginning of March. This was all I needed. With the help of Madan Kumar Babu, a public meeting was convened at the town hall, and my proposal that the sacred relics should be invited to visit Kalimpong having been carried unanimously, the Strong Representative Committee, as it was called, was set up as required, with Rani Chini Dorji as chairman, the abbot of Tarpal Choling Gompa as vice chairman, Gyan Jyoti as treasurer, and myself as general secretary. While I was thus engaged, I received a letter from Venerable Sangharatana. He and Kashyapji would be accompanying the sacred relics to Sikkim, he wrote, together with Dr. Madhav Ram Soft, one of the vice presidents of the Mahabodhi Society. Would I like to accompany them as part of the official delegation? 2 months were not really sufficient to look after the sacred relics, and they would be glad of my company. This offer came like the answer to an unspoken wish. Though I had been in Kalimpong for more than 10 months, I had as yet not visited the tiny Himalayan principality on the other side of the river, and the prospect of establishing contact with the Sikkimese Buddhists and perhaps seeing Mount Kanchenjunga at closer quarters was one that appealed to me considerably. Moreover, the fact that I would be going to Sikkim with the sacred relics, as well as in the company of Venerable Sangharatana and my teacher Kashyapji, made the idea of such a visit doubly attractive, especially as I had not seen or heard from Kashyapji since my ordination at Sarnath, and wanted to talk to him about events that had led to my departure from the Dharmodaya Vihara. I therefore wrote to Venerable Sangharatana, thanking him for his kind offer and assuring him that I would be delighted to be with him and Kashyapji in Gangtok at the end of February. Already I could see in my mind's eye the curved yellow roofs rising above the treetops and red-robed figures blowing a deep-throated welcome to the sacred relics from giant copper trumpets. But there was little time for such dreams, though the strong representative committee had been set up, and though at least some of its 24 members could be relied upon to attend the meetings I called at the town hall from time to time, I very quickly discovered that by far the greater part of the actual work of organising the reception of the sacred relics would devolve on the General Secretary. Indeed, it was expected that it would devolve on him. Most of the public-spirited citizens who had constituted themselves into the Sacred Relics Reception Committee, Kalimpong, or who had allowed themselves to be co-opted onto it, were evidently of the opinion that being a member of the committee indicated not that one was prepared to work for it, but only that one gave it one's moral support, and, of course, the benefit of one's advice. Even the chairman of the committee, I soon realised, was no exception to the general rule. Rani Dorji had not accepted the position of chairman out of any great desire to help, as I had at first hoped was the case, despite my previous experience of her marked lack of interest in Buddhist activities, but only because she had been pressed by her fellow citizens to such an extent that she could hardly refuse without giving a good deal of offence. For their part, the fellow citizens had pressed her to accept the position not because they really expected her to do anything, but because, as the head of the most prominent Buddhist family in the locality, Raja S. T. Dorji was away in Bhutan, she was expected to take the lead, at least nominally, in all matters affecting the Buddhist community. As Madan Kumar Babu remarked, that was the way things were done in Kalimpong. For the next few weeks, I was therefore busier than I had been since my arrival in the town. Nearly every morning I made my way from the peace and seclusion of Burma Raja's guest's cottage to the comparative noise and bustle of the bazaar, where, more often than not, I spent the greater part of the day, sometimes with no other refreshment than the cups of Indian or Tibetan tea, and biscuits if it was before noon, that I was given at the various houses, shops and offices at which I called. Not only did I get much less help from the other members of the committee than I had expected, but the actual work of organising the reception proved to be much greater than anyone had foreseen. There were posters and handbills to be distributed, vehicles to be hired for the conveyance of the sacred relics and the accompanying delegation, arches of welcome to be erected all along the route by which the sacred relics would pass, permission to take out the procession to be obtained from the police, correspondence to be conducted with Devapriya Valasinha and Venerable Sangharatana, as well as with friends and well-wishers throughout the subdivision, and of course funds to be collected. All this was in addition to my usual work of running the YMBA, which included taking the evening tutorial classes at our new premises on the ground floor of Banshee's Godown and producing an issue of Stepping Stones every month and dispatching it to our subscribers. Fortunately, Gyan Jyoti took his duties as treasurer quite seriously and not only kept the accounts but did the greater part of the fundraising. I also had a certain amount of help from two other members of the committee. These were Marco Pallas, who was in any case a regular visitor to the guest cottage, and Mr. Lal Tsering, the formidable boss of the local branch of the Central Intelligence Bureau, the mention of whose name as his father by one of the boys in my matriculation class some months previously had occasioned so much laughter among the rest of the class. Marco Pallas and Lal Tsering knew each other quite well, but although relations between the two men were amicable enough, I had the impression that neither took the other very seriously. Whenever Lal Tsering mentioned Marco Pallas, it was with a snort of good-natured contempt, while whenever Marco Pallas referred to Lal Tsering, it was with uplifted eyebrows and eyes that twinkled with amusement. Marco had, in fact, playfully christened Lal Tsering the long-lived Deva, this being the literal translation of his Tibetan name, and as the long-lived Deva we always spoke of him, especially when we were not sure who might be listening in to our conversation. Since there was a feeling in Kalimpong that in view of Lao Tsering's position as head of the local intelligence network, it was not wise to be overheard talking about him, especially if one happened to be a foreigner. Marco Pallas helped me, mainly by functioning as my guide, philosopher and friend, as well as my interpreter, whenever I had to have dealings with the Tibetan Buddhists, which was quite frequently. The Kenpo, or abbot of the Tapa Cholin Gompa, having been elected vice president of the reception committee, it was necessary to keep him informed about what was happening, as well as to consult with him and his monks about the arrangements for the procession, the success of which would depend largely on their cooperation. At least once a week, therefore, Marco and I walked from the development area to the bazaar, and from the bazaar up the winding, dusty track that led to Tiapai and the Tapa Cholin Gompa, my companion usually discoursing all the way on tradition, Tibetan Buddhism, the regrettable tendency of local youth to adopt Western dress, the corruption of the modern world, and other favourite topics. No sooner had we arrived at the Gompa than it was clear that Marco Pallas, or Thubten Tenzing, as perhaps I should now start calling him, was a regular visitor there. It was also clear that he was well liked by the monks, who, on account of his devotion to the Dharma, the fluency with which he spoke Tibetan, and his familiarity with their manners and customs, indeed held him in high regard. Probably there was no other person in Kalimpong, certainly no other European, whose companionship could have ensured me a more favourable reception at the Gompa. On the occasion of my first visit, Thubten Tenzing provided me with the usual kata, or white ceremonial scarf, to offer to the abbot, who received us in the upstairs room of his modest quarters on the northern side of the grassy square in front of the temple. It was quite a small room with a glass-fronted shrine at the far end and a row of square Tibetan cushions down either side, the abbot's cushion, actually two or three cushions, piled one on top of the other, being higher than the rest and situated next to the carved and gilded shrine, behind the panes of which was a strange assortment of images, photographs, biscuit tins and artificial flowers. The abbot could not have been much less than 60, which I knew was quite an advanced age for a Tibetan. A gaunt, almost emaciated figure, he sat up very stiff and straight in his maroon-covered woolen robes, with the projecting shoulder pieces and the hint of red and gold brocade underneath. With his bald head and sunken cheeks, and his prominent, strongly aquiline nose, he looked for all the world like a weather-beaten old eagle perched alone on his solitary crag. At first, the conversation was mainly between him and Thubten Tenzing, who evidently knew him quite well, and on whom he beamed with considerable satisfaction. Though he nodded and chuckled from time to time, he did not say very much, being seemingly content to allow Thubten Tenzing to do most of the talking. Eventually, he turned a friendly and sympathetic, but I thought slightly ironic gaze on me. To which honourable country did the honourable monk belong, and was his honourable body free from affliction? Whereupon there ensued, with Thubten Tenzing acting as interpreter, a conversation which gradually took on a more informal tone, and in the course of which the abbot showed signs of increasing interest and goodwill. He was particularly intrigued by the colour and pattern of my robes, which, of course, were not red but yellow, and made not of wool but of cotton, uttering exclamations of surprise and delight when it was discovered that the number of patches of which they consisted corresponded to the number of patches on the yellow silk robes which the Tibetan monks themselves wore on ceremonial occasions over their more customary maroon-covered garments. While we were talking, one of the abbot's monk attendants shuffled in and out with a huge Tibetan teapot, filling and refilling the delicate Chinese cups which he had previously placed on the low carved tables before us. He carried the teapot in shoulder high, and as he bent down to serve each person, he gave it a vigorous sideways shake before pouring out the tea, which naturally was Tibetan buttered tea, and of the finest quality I had as yet tasted. In contrast to the cups that had been given Thubten Tenzing and myself, the abbot's cup, which stood in readiness on his own much higher and more elaborately carved table, was provided with an ornate gold and silver stand, and a still more ornate gold and silver cover, on the pointed top of which was a large semi-precious stone by way of a knob. Having compared notes on the subject of robes, it was only natural that we should proceed to discuss the Vinaya, or monastic code in general, and here too the abbot was surprised and delighted to find that we had much in common. Though not really surprised, I was no less delighted than he was. I already knew that the Tapa Choling Gompa was a Gelugpa establishment, and that the so-called Yellow Hat monks of the Gelugpa order observed a version of the Hinayana monastic code that was not substantially different from that of the tradition into which I had myself been ordained. Thus, I knew that they were celibate, that they were supposed to abstain from alcohol and from taking solid food after midday, and so on. But though I knew at least something about them, they did not really know anything about me. While the abbot and the other inmates of the Tapa Choling Gompa had often seen me going on my arms round, a practice that was followed only by the poorest and least respected Tibetan monks, all that they as yet knew, or thought they knew about me, was that I was a follower of the Hinayana, or Little Way, of Emancipation, and not of the Mahayana, or Great Way, and not, therefore, a follower of the Bodhisattva ideal. But which version of the monastic code I followed, or whether I followed the monastic code at all, they had no idea. With my shaven head, my yellow cotton robes, and my black begging bowl — Tibetan monks, I subsequently learned, hardly ever possessed begging bowls — I was in their eyes an antiquated figure out of the remote, legendary Indian past of Buddhism, a figure such as they had seen, if at all, only in paintings of episodes from the life of the Buddha. Now that they had actually met me, and had some idea of who and what I was, their natural suspicions were allayed, and by the end of that first conversation with the abbot, I had been able to secure their cooperation in carrying out my plan of taking these sacred relics in a grand procession through the streets of Kalimpong. Indeed, the abbot assured me that he and his monks were willing to do anything that would help enhance the prestige and extend the influence of the Dharma in the region. In the course of my subsequent visits to the Tiapai Gompa, as it was popularly known, I drank many more cups of Tibetan buttered tea with the old abbot, and discussed many more subjects, Thubten Tenzing always interpreting. It was not long before we passed from the minutiae of the monastic code to doctrinal and spiritual issues of a more general and more fundamental nature. Thubten Tenzing enjoyed these discussions immensely, translating from Tibetan to English and English to Tibetan with tremendous zest, and from time to time interposing comments of his own for the benefit of one or the other of us. For him, they were perhaps reminiscent of the Spituk debates, that is to say, of the discussions he and his two mountaineering companions had with the Venerable Dawa, Bursa of Spituk, in Ladakh 15 years earlier, as described in the pages of Peaks and Lamas. Perhaps the most fundamental issue to be touched upon by the abbot and myself in our discussions at the Tapa Choling Gompa was that of the Bodhisattva ideal, which Thubten Tenzing rightly regarded as the presiding idea, as he termed it, of Tibetan Buddhism. The presiding idea, being indeed the title of the extra chapter that he was to add to a later edition of his famous book. Though it was the abbot himself who first referred to the Bodhisattva ideal, from the cautious and tentative way in which he approached the subject, I could see that he was unsure what my own attitude towards it might be, and that he was, in fact, sounding me out. Since the Bodhisattva ideal had come to occupy a more and more central place in my spiritual life, I had no hesitation in assuring the abbot that I accepted it unreservedly, and that in, quote, the concept of bodhisattvahood, the state of the fully awakened being who, though under no further restraint, by that law of causality which he had transcended, yet freely continues to espouse the vicissitudes of the round of existence, in virtue of his self-identification with all the creatures still involved in egocentric delusion and consequent suffering, end of quote. As Thubten Tenzin was to describe it, I found a constant source of inspiration. This assurance the venerable old man received with exclamations of surprise and delight, even more emphatic than that had greeted the discovery about the number of patches on my robes. If I accepted the Bodhisattva ideal, I was a follower of the Mahayana. And if I was a follower of the Mahayana, then, despite outward differences, I was one of them. All this was conveyed not so much in words as by a truly wonderful expression of benign satisfaction that lit up the abbot's careworn countenance and sparkled in his red-rimmed eyes. It was as though he rejoiced that yet another human being had, however imperfectly, dedicated himself to the cause of universal emancipation. The fact that I was now known to be one of them, despite my yellow cotton robes, made my dealings with the Tibetan Buddhists easier than they might otherwise have been, even with the help of Thubten Tenzin. I experienced no difficulty in finalizing with the abbot and his monks the arrangements for the procession, and no difficulty even when it came to securing their cooperation in a matter of still greater importance. This was the actual exposition of the sacred relics. Devapriya Valensina had informed me that the sacred relics could stay in Kalimpong for 4 days, and I had therefore proposed to the reception committee that during this period they should be kept at the Tapa Choling Gompa and be exposed there each day for the veneration of the public. The Tapa Choling Gompa was the biggest and most important Buddhist monastery in Kalimpong, and to me it was obvious that the sacred relics could be kept there and nowhere else. To keep them anywhere else would be an affront to the Tibetans, who were the major Buddhist community in Kalimpong, and for whom the Gompa was the centre of their religious and cultural life. At first, the committee was inclined to agree with me, but as the discussion proceeded, dissentient voices were raised, and I became aware that there was a strong undercurrent of opposition to the idea of keeping the sacred relics at the Thapa Choling Gompa and holding the exposition there. This opposition eventually came out into the open and was found to consist mainly of Rani Dorji and Kian Jyoti. Why they objected to keeping the sacred relics at the Thapa Choling Gompa was not clear, though Mr. Tharchin, who had somehow got onto the committee, expressed concern lest the monks of the Gompa should start fighting over the custody of the sacred relics, a concern that the bursar and precentor, who were attending the meeting as representatives of the abbot, indignantly declared to be totally without foundation. Discussion then shifted to the question of access. Was the Gompa not situated at a considerable distance from the Kalimpong Bazaar, and would it not be a cause of great hardship to people if they had to walk all the way up to Tirpai in order to have darshan of the sacred relics? Why not keep the sacred relics at the Dharmodya Vihara, which was near the centre of the town, and have the exposition there? This last suggestion was made by Rani Dorji, who made it with an air of bland impartiality, as though she was only trying to be helpful, and it was eagerly taken up by Gyan Jyoti, who expatiated at length on the advantages of holding the exposition at the Vihara and having the sacred relics practically on people's doorsteps, so to speak. Aniruddha, who was also present, gave his support to Rani Dorji's suggestion in his own rough way. "That's right," he shouted. "Why should they be kept up at the Gompa? Let's keep them at Dharmodaya. That's the proper place." It was now clear that I was not going to get my proposal accepted by the committee without a struggle, since although the majority of its members were in favour of keeping the sacred relics at the Tapa Choling Gompa, they hesitated to oppose so prominent and influential a person as Rani Dorji, especially as many of them did not have very strong feelings about the matter anyway. I therefore told them bluntly that the idea that the religious-minded people of Kalimpong would not be prepared to walk the 2 miles from the bazaar up to Tia Pai in order to pay their respects to the sacred relics was ridiculous. Why, small children walked 3 or 4 miles to school every day of the week and thought nothing of it. Hill people were born walkers. These sentiments met with general approval, one elderly Tamang Buddhist going so far as to declare that, speaking personally, he would be happy to walk 100 miles in order to have the opportunity of worshipping the sacred relics. The opposition was forced to change its ground. Why should the sacred relics be kept either at the Gompa or at the Vihara, or in fact in any place that was identified with a particular section of the community? Why not keep them at the town hall, which belonged to all the people of Kalimpong, and where everybody would feel free to go? This suggestion seemed to find greater favour with the committee than had the previous one, and I was careful to refute it at some length. Though the town hall was nearer to the centre of the town, and though it indeed belonged to all the people of Kalimpong, it was in a dirty and dilapidated condition, as they all knew very well. This was a reference to recent unsuccessful attempts to clean up the place, and it would not be fitting for the exposition of these sacred relics to be held in such dingy surroundings. Moreover, the town hall was used for all sorts of secular purposes, and was hardly the most suitable venue for a function of a purely religious nature. Above all, people smoked bidis and cigarettes in the town hall, and for the purity of the sacred relics to be polluted by their being kept for 4 days in the smoke-laden atmosphere of the place would be deeply offensive to the religious feelings of all Buddhists. To this last argument in particular, even Rani Dorji had nothing to say, since it was a matter of common knowledge that the very thought of tobacco was abhorrent to the traditionally minded followers of Tibetan Buddhism, whether Tibetans, Bhutanese, Sikkimese, or Nepalese. The 13th Dalai Lama had actually forbidden the import of cigarettes into Tibet. And after I had headed off a last-minute attempt by the opposition to revive the claims of the Dharmodaya Vihara, it was finally decided that for the 4 days that they would be in Kalimpong, the sacred relics would be kept at the Tapa Choling Gompa. The meeting at which the debate over where to keep the sacred relics took place was the longest and liveliest of all the meetings of our reception committee. Unfortunately, it was also the most unpleasant, for although the amenities were observed, Rani Dorji in particular treated everyone with scrupulous politeness, there was a growing tension in the atmosphere which could, I felt, easily result in an explosion. This tension was connected with the fact that while Rani Dorji carefully refrained from saying anything detrimental to the Tapa Choling Gompa, she was clearly determined that the sacred relics should not be kept there, and lost no opportunity of giving her support to any alternative proposal. Why this should be the case, I was unable to tell. Gyan Jyoti wanted the sacred relics to be kept at the Dharmodaya Vihara, not out of any actual hostility to the Gompa, but simply because he was a Niwa and wanted the honour to go to the religious and cultural centre of his own community. As for Aniruddha, he was not only a Niwar but also a staunch Theravadin, and thought it was only right and proper that the remains of two Theravadin Arahants, as he regarded them, should be lodged at the Theravadin Vihara. But Rani Dorji was nominally at least a follower of Tibetan Buddhism in its Bhutanese, that is, Drukpa Kagyu form. And why she should be so opposed to the idea of keeping the sacred relics at the Tapa Choling Gompa was a mystery. Opposed, however, she undoubtedly was. For as the claims of the Vihara and the town hall were gradually demolished, the little woman's stony face became stonier still, her bloodless lips more tightly compressed, while her eyes began to glitter with a look that was positively baleful. By the time the meeting was over and my proposal at length accepted, it was evident that, despite the frozen ceremoniousness of her departure, Rani Dorji was very, very angry at the way things had turned out, though the reason for her anger, as for her opposition, still remained a mystery. The mystery was cleared up 2 or 3 days later, when I happened to visit Mr. La Sering. The abode of the long-lived Deva was not far from 10th Mile, down the same lane as that in which Rudramani Pradhan's modest bungalow was situated, and I had got into the habit of calling there quite frequently, partly because the weather was at that time bitterly cold, and I was glad to be able to warm myself at the glowing charcoal brazier that stood in the middle of the room, and partly because he was always glad to see me and always ready to lend a sympathetic ear if I wanted to discuss anything. Sikkimese by birth, he had spent the war years as an officer in the British Army, from which he had only recently retired. With his short, well-brushed hair, shining pink face, and generally spruce appearance, he was, despite his slant eyes and gold teeth, very much the ex-army officer. As I soon discovered, he was strongly pro-British. I also discovered that, although of a frank and open disposition, he was prone to violent outbursts of temper. During one of my earlier visits, he had been so enraged by the mistakes a clerk had made in typing out a report that he had flung the bulky file at the man's head with fearful imprecations. On another occasion, it was that of my first visit, I had myself come very near to provoking a similar outburst. Thinking the news would please him, I told him that his son was one of the most promising students in my matriculation class, and that he would be sure to do well at college. To my amazement, the long-lived Deva's face turned first scarlet, then purple, and he seemed about to explode. Controlling himself with a tremendous effort and swallowing hard 2 or 3 times, he abruptly changed the subject, and I realised that I had somehow committed a serious faux pas. Only later did I learn that although Nangyal, as the boy was called, was indeed the son of the long-lived Deva, the latter, despite the extraordinary facial resemblance between them, obstinately refused to recognise him as such. Fortunately, the incident did not interfere with the growth of our friendship, and we were soon on quite confidential terms. If he was busy when I called, he would hand me a batch of intelligence reports and ask me to, quote, check the English for him while I waited. Most of the reports, I noticed, related to people staying at or living in the Himalayan Hotel. This did not surprise me very much, since I knew the place had a bad reputation in more ways than one, and that the long-lived Deva himself often looked in there of an evening just to keep an eye on things. Why he should have taken such a strong liking to me, it was difficult to say, but a strong liking to me he undoubtedly had taken. There were times when his attitude towards me was positively protective, even fatherly, which seemed strange in view of the way in which he chose to treat one of his own sons. Years later, when he had long ceased to be the much-feared boss of the local intelligence network, a friend we had in common offered a possible explanation. A few months after my arrival in Kalimpong, she said, he had seen me going for alms in the bazaar and had been deeply moved by the sight, remarking, "There goes someone who really believes in Buddhism." Such was Mr. La Tsering, the long-lived Deva, the remaining member of the committee, from whom, as from Gyanjoti and Thubten Tenzin, I had a certain amount of help in the work of organising the reception to the sacred relics. When I told him about the decision to keep the latter at the Tapa Cholingompa, and about Rani Dorji's strange behaviour, he threw back his head and laughed until the tears ran down his cheeks. "How he wished he had been there," he exclaimed, slapping his thigh with delight. "How he wished he could have seen Rani Dorji's face when, for once in her life, she did not get her own way." What a pity he had had to attend another meeting that afternoon. He would willingly have given 100 rupees to have been able to hear our discussion. Seeing that I did not share his mirth, however, and was evidently in the dark about certain matters, he wiped the tears from his eyes with a pocket handkerchief and suddenly became quite serious, even grim. Of course the sacred relics should be kept at the Tapa Cholingompa. It was the only place where they could possibly be kept. There was absolutely no question of keeping them either at a hotbed of newer selfishness and sectarianism like the Dharmodi Vihara, where I myself had been so shabbily treated, or in a filthy hole like the town hall. As for Rani Dorji's determination that the sacred relics should not be kept at the Tapa Cholingompa, this was not in the least surprising. She had very good reasons of her own for not wanting them to be kept there. If they were kept there, then, as chairman of the reception committee, she would be obliged to go to the Gompa in order to receive them on their arrival, whereas it was well known that she had vowed never to set foot in the Gompa again. If she were to go to the Gompa, it would, therefore, mean that she was being made to eat her own words, so to speak, with consequent loss of prestige. And prestige, as I had lived long enough in the area to know, the long-lived Deva added smilingly, was something to which Tibetans and people of Tibetan religion and culture attached tremendous importance. No, it was not in the least surprising that Rani Dorji had not wanted the sacred relics to be kept at the Tapa Cholingompa, or that she had been so ready to support any alternative proposal. The reason for the stony-faced little Rani's behaviour at the meeting, as well as for the state of suppressed fury in which she had departed, was now explained. But why had she vowed never to set foot in the Tapa Cholingompa again? Far from having been cleared up, the mystery had only deepened. While thoughts like these were passing through my mind, my violent-tempered friend was evidently trying to decide how much about local politics I really needed to know. At length he appeared to have made up his mind to tell me at least enough to enable me to understand the situation which, all unwittingly, I had found myself involved. Shortly before my arrival in Kalimpong, he explained, there had been some trouble at the Tapa Cholingompa. Parties had been formed among the monks, and some of the lay supporters of the monastery had been drawn into the conflict, among them Rani Dorji. Eventually the trouble became quite serious, and actual fighting broke out, and in the course of this fighting, a monk was killed. The situation was, of course, extremely complicated, and it was difficult to apportion blame. But Rani Dorji had been deeply involved in the conflict, and, rightly or wrongly, it was widely believed in Kalimpong that she was morally responsible for the monk's death, and people criticised her accordingly. Rani Dorji herself acknowledged no responsibility for what had happened, but the fact that her association with the Gompa had led to her being criticised had infuriated her to such an extent that she had publicly vowed never to set foot in the Tapa Cholingompa again. In the light of these disclosures, I saw that I had perhaps made a second enemy in Kalimpong, and one much more formidable than the portly, lying editor of the Himalayan Times. I was also worried in case there was, after all, some basis to Mr. Tharchin's concern lest the monks of the Gompa should start fighting over the custody of the sacred relics. But the long-lived Deva was quick to reassure me on this point. The troubles at the Gompa had long since been settled, he declared emphatically, and a formal ceremony of reconciliation would take place as soon as the necessary officials of the Tibetan government arrived from Lhasa. This, at least, was good news, but it could not disguise the fact that what my presumably well-informed friend had just told me about the politics of Kalimpong revealed a state of affairs that was deeply disturbing. In particular, it was disturbing that a conflict at the Gompa should actually have resulted in the death of one of the monks, and hardly less dreadful that the repercussions of the tragedy should still be felt within the Buddhist community, and had even threatened to disrupt our arrangements for the reception of the sacred relics. It was also disappointing, to say the least, that someone in Rani Dorji's position should have meddled in the affairs of the Gompa in such a way as to earn for herself the execrations of the public. Though she did not have a very attractive personality, I had hitherto been under the impression that she was well respected in Kalimpong and even quite popular. When I told the long-lived Dave of this, his reaction was one of scornful amusement. Rani Dorji respected. Rani Dorji popular? If I was under that impression, then the sooner I corrected it, the better. She might be popular with the Europeans who hobnobbed with her at Bhutan House, or with the Church of Scotland missionaries, whose work she was always praising, but she was certainly not popular with the local people. In fact, she was decidedly unpopular, and with good reason. Though it hurt him to have to criticise Rani Dorji, who was by birth a Sikkimese princess and the sister of his own Maharaja, the truth was that she was the most cold, selfish, narrow-minded, hard-hearted, grasping, avaricious, miserly person that anyone could possibly meet. She was even worse than the Mawaris and the Niwas, which were saying a good deal. All she cared about was money. She was so mean that if she saw a red farthing lying in the filth of the gutter, she would bend down and pick it up. Did I know that she was a licensed moneylender? I did not, any more than I knew a moneylender had to have a license. Not only did she lend money to the local peasantry at high rates of interest on their security of their land, but the minute they failed to keep up with their repayments, as they usually did sooner or later, she either had them sold up or seized their land and put in her own people as tenants. She was utterly without mercy, and provided she could make a bit more money, thought nothing of driving honest folk from their homes and turning them and their children into paupers and beggars. It wasn't as though she didn't have more than enough money already. The Dorjis were the richest family in the whole area. They were multi-millionaires. Practically the whole of the trade between India and Bhutan was in their hands. Next to the royal family itself, they were the biggest landowners in Bhutan. But Rani Dorji always wanted more. While he was delivering this tirade, the long-lived Deva's initial scornful amusement changed to undisguised hatred and contempt, and I could see that his feelings towards Rani Dorji were much the same as Danman Mokchan's feelings towards the Jyoti brothers and the Niwas. There were certainly a lot of animosities within the Kalimpong Buddhist community. Those feelings did not extend to Rani Dorji's husband, Raja S.T. Dorji. The Raja Saheb, so the long-lived Deva assured me, was a completely different type of person from his wife. He was as generous as she was tight-fisted, and as warm and open-hearted as she was cold and reserved. It was, therefore, hardly surprising that whereas she was unpopular with local people, he was very popular with them. There were indeed those who treated Rani Dorji with respect only on account of their regard for Raja Dorji, and because she herself was connected by birth with the ruling house of Sikkim. The Raja Saheb was in fact both a popular and a respected figure in Kalimpong, as well as the object of much affection to those who knew him personally. He was highly approachable, and in time of need could be a true friend, as he himself, the long-lived Deva, declared with some warmth, had found on more than one occasion. As a young man, he had spent quite a lot of time with Raja Dorji. They had gone shooting together. But that was many years ago, before the war, and now they hardly ever saw each other. Despite his noble qualities, the Raja Saheb was very much under his wife's thumb, and since he, the Raja Saheb, knew what he, the speaker, thought of Rani Dorji, it seemed better that they should not meet. To me it was dreadful that two men who had been as close to each other as the long-lived Deva and Raja Dorji had evidently been in their youth should be kept apart by a woman like Rani Dorji, and for the next few days the story gave me hardly less food for thought than did my irascible friend's revelations about local politics and about Rani Dorji's unpopularity. Not that I really had much time to think about any of these matters, however, even for that shorter period. Now that the committee had finally decided that these sacred relics should be kept at the Tapa Choling Gompa, I was busier than ever, and my visits with Thubten Tenzin to the wind-buffeted old eagle abbot became more frequent and more prolonged. As before, discussion was by no means limited to the details of the procession, or, now that the sacred relics were to be kept at the Gompa, to the arrangements that would have to be made for their exposition, as well as for the accommodation of the accompanying delegation. On one occasion, the abbot continued the process of sounding me out, this time on the subject of Madhyamika dialectics. "What is the cause of shunyata?" he abruptly demanded with a severe expression. I replied that shunyata, or voidness, being the ultimate reality, the conception of causality was inapplicable. But the abbot shook his head decisively. That was not the answer. The result was that during the next 10 or 12 years I spent quite a lot of time puzzling over the meaning of the old man's question. It's stuck with me like a Zen koan, and in much the same way as the Zen disciple asks himself with ever-increasing intensity, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" I kept asking myself, "What is the cause of shunyata?" The reply I'd given to the abbot was not incorrect, but it was obviously not the last word that could be said on the subject. Preparations for the reception of the sacred relics were still underway when I received two letters that materially altered our plans. The first letter was from Devapriya Valasinha. Interest in the sacred relics having spread like wildfire throughout the entire eastern Himalayan region, he wrote. Invitations had now been received from the people of Darjeeling, as well as from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who was at present staying at Yatung, in southern Tibet, not far from the border between Tibet and Sikkim. The sacred relics would therefore be going from Gangtok to Yatung, which meant that they would arrive in Kangpong 2 or 3 weeks later than originally planned. The second letter was from Venerable Sangharatana. Since I would in any case be joining the delegation in Sikkim and helping him and Kashyapji look after the sacred relics there, would I like to accompany them to Tibet, as well as to Darjeeling? The news seemed too good to be true. It was as though another unspoken wish had been answered. Deeply moved, I spent the next 2 or 3 weeks ensuring that my absence from Kalimpong for so long a period would not jeopardize the success of our reception, and making ready for my journey to Sikkim and Tibet. End of chapter 10.